Okay, the main goal of the Seder is Bechol Dor Vador Chayiv Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ki Ilu Hu Yatsa Mimitzrayim. That through the Seder somehow a person should identify as if he personally went out of Mitzrayim. Okay. Let me ask you honestly, how many of you in any of the Sdorim that you have ever been at felt that you were a slave in Egypt and went out that night? I didn't think so. What? Right. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, except...
Not that I was a slave, but I could feel the going out bit.
Oh, okay. My wife tells me the opposite. She could feel like she was a slave. She never felt she went out. Okay, in any case, so what does that mean? I've asked this question to thousands of people, literally, all over the world. And I never got anybody who said that they did. So does that mean the Seder is... Maybe great people feel like that, haven't asked them. But does that mean the mitzvah can't be accomplished? What does it mean? So I think that what it means, what a person has to feel, is on three levels. And the truth is that the whole Seder Pesach revolves around your mouth. In fact, the whole Pesach revolves around the mouth. Pesach, mouth that speaks. Paro is para, bad mouth. The geula of Mitzrayim was a double pay. Pakod pakadati eschem. And the Aleph Beis, there's two pays. There's what's called a pesosum, a closed pay, that's in the middle of the letter in the beginning. And then there's an open pay, the end of the letter. What I like to explain, pay obviously is a mouth. There's an open mouth and a closed mouth. When you eat, your mouth is closed. At least that's what my mother told me. Right? And when you speak, your mouth is opened. So that's what the Seder is all about. Either you're eating or you're speaking. There's nothing else to the Seder. Right? That's what the Seder is. And it's interesting, in this week's Sedra, we have the birth of a person, which is discussed, the halachas of birth, sandwiched, with no pun intended, between the things you're allowed to eat and not allowed to eat, and what you're allowed to speak and not speak, tzaras, which has to do with Lashon Hara. So you see that there's a very, very central point of speaking and eating. What the mouth ingests helps to make a person, and what the mouth speaks, because speaking is what our humanity is. A human being is a being that speaks. Nefesh memalala. That's what distinguishes us from the animal. Our intelligent speech, sometimes not intelligent speech. But in any case, so therefore it's sandwiched between those two things. What you ingest with your mouth and what you speak with your mouth. And then the middle of that is the birth of a person. In any case, I want to relate it more to the Seder. How eating and speaking help you to identify with Yetzias Mitzrayim. The first level is through the speaking. Right? Speaking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, we remember Yetzias Mitzrayim every day, twice a day. There are a host of mitzvahs that are Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. We once explained in detail why Yetzias Mitzrayim is the foundation of our belief. Because every nation has traditions. If you were born a Christian, you'd have the traditions of Christianity. And it was passed on by tradition. Parents tell their children, their parents told them, and so on, all the way back to the people who were there. Same thing with Islam. So what differentiates us from them? We also have a tradition that our parents told us, all the way back to the people of Mitzrayim. We explained, the way the Kuzri explains, and I think once we spoke about it in great detail, that the foundation of our Mesorah is significantly different than the foundation of the Mesorah of any other religion, especially the major religions that we're familiar with, Christianity and Islam. If you trace them back to their source, they're basically based on hearsay or on events that happen in the testimony, the witness of very small, biased group of people. The foundations of Christianity is that Yeshua was the Son of God. Now, who could testify to that? right? God didn't go around telling people that this is his son, right? Nobody was a witness to God giving out cigars when he was born, right? So we don't know if he was, you know, his father or not, right? He claimed to be the son of God. Okay, you believe him, you don't believe him.
But smoking wasn't good for people,
that's why. And he supposedly died on the cross and was resurrected. How many people witnessed that? So there the New Testament says, their version is that his closest disciples saw it, and a group of fainting women. Now his closest disciples had a vested interest in saying he came back, because otherwise they were out of a job. And fainting women, not to impugn the credibility of women, but fainting women, I could see anything or think anything. So wasn't exactly the most credible testimony. Islam is even worse. The whole foundation of Islam is that Muhammad had a dream in a cave one night that the angel Gabriel came to him and revealed to him the Quran and told him to spread his religion. Okay? Nobody videoed the dream. Nobody witnessed it with him. He may have had a dream. May have had a stomach ache and had a nightmare that night. Whatever it was, could have had a dream. But nobody can be, it's his word. He had a very cogent intellectual argument that spread his religion like wildfire, went something like this: accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that to be extremely convincing. So these religions spread, and the Rambam says the Rabbanim Shalom wanted these religions to spread. Not for now, why? But that's, so God gave them a lot of success, so people believed him. But if you trace it to the source, it stands on very shaky ground. Same thing with our religion. If it had started the same way of theirs, meaning Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam came to the Jews settled in Tel Aviv and told them, listen, you gotta hear what happened to us. We were backpacking through Egypt, we got captured, were put to be slaves, and then God brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians and got us out of there, and we crossed the Red Sea, and God spoke to us and gave us his Torah, and believe us. Then it'd be the same thing. Right? The word of three people, of what they saw, what they experienced, what they heard, and you believe them, you don't believe them. But that's not what happened. What happened was that it happened in front of an entire nation. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't tell the people, I saw. He said, you saw all these things. You saw the 10 plagues. You went through the Red Sea. You heard God speak at Har Sinai. And we explained once in great detail, I'm not going to go through that now, why we have a tradition that that happened. There's five ways that that could have happened, that the tradition got to us. One way is it actually happened. And the people who were there passed it on, or if you like, passed it over to the next generation or whatever, until we got it. There's four other possibilities. And they are all improbable. One possibility is it never happened. Moshe Rabbeinu convinced an entire nation that they saw things they didn't see, and they passed it on like that. Right, as if they actually saw it. Very improbable that anybody could convince an entire nation they saw things they didn't see, especially Jews. Right? One of the Shlomo Shofar Hirsch says that I could convince you that I'm somebody that I'm not, or I saw something I didn't see. Very difficult for me to convince you you saw something you didn't see. And even if you can do it to individuals, but to an entire nation, and they should pass this on as if they actually saw it, very improbable. Second possibility, it never happened. Nobody ever convinced them that it happened. They made it up. It's a hoax. The entire nation got together and made this up. Why would they do such a thing? Because they wanted to give their children a glorious heritage. Right? They're a bunch of slaves. That's not such a nice, glorious heritage. But if all these miracles happen, sounds good. So they passed this on as if it happened. It's improbable because they tacked on a Torah with a lot of laws that were very oppressive at the time and difficult to keep even now. For instance, the Torah says that you can't marry close relatives. In Egypt, that was the norm. And in fact, even the Jews married close relatives. Amram and Yocheved were aunt and nephew, which is also in the Torah. So they had to give up their relatives who were they married to because of this Torah. Right? They had to get divorced. It says that they were crying because once they got the Torah and they heard these halachas, they had to get divorced. But in general, all the halachas in the Torah, if I didn't believe that God said to put on little black boxes on your arm and your head at 5 o'clock in the morning, right? And I believe that somebody made it up, 3,000, there's no way in the world I would do it. I can't understand how anyone who doesn't believe that the Torah is divine would do anything. Sit in a sukkah or whatever. What's the purpose of it? Somebody decided to do this 3,000 years ago, I should go put little black boxes on my arm? For what? But if I believe that God gave it, and my life depends on it, my future life depends on it, I'll do it. But otherwise, why in the world would I want to do it? And here are parents who know that they made up the whole thing. Yom Kippur and Pesach and Taras and Mishpacha, everything's all made up. And they know there's nothing to it, and they foist this on their children. What kind of abusive parents? And even if you have some abusive parents, but an entire nation who are abusive parents. And usually people on their deathbed, you know, admit that they made up these lies. Why would they do that? Call in your children and say, listen, you know the black boxes? Forget about it. We made it up. Right? So, improbable that an entire nation would foist on their children such a hoax. Third possibility. It didn't happen. Nobody ever witnessed it. Somebody made it up 1,000 years ago. Ezra. It was a rainy day one day. Had nothing to do. He made up the Torah. And he told the people in Babylonia that he just discovered this Torah. They should start keeping it. Okay. Also improbable. Again, it's not just he wanted to give them a glorious history, right? Make up a history of 1,000 years before so they shouldn't feel so low being in Gaulis, right? Give them hope for the future. But he put in a Torah too that said you can't marry non-Jews, and they had to give up their non-Jewish spouses because of this Torah he discovered. Some Jew in the back is going to raise his hand and say, Ezra, if this really happened 1,000 years ago, how come nobody ever heard about it except for you? Don't you think there'd be some record somebody would have heard about it? And if it never happened, nobody could have heard about it until Ezra made it up. So again, very difficult that Ezra could convince an entire nation to accept something they never heard of because it never happened. Right, and tack on a Torah that they have to keep, right? Just because he said so. The fifth possibility is that it happened, but not the way the Torah said. It happened, but you know, they were overworked in Egypt, they made a sit-down strike, they got out, they jumped over a puddle, and over 1,000 years it became Eser Makos, Kriyas Yamsuf. It changed, like the game telephone. Right? Pass something on, and you know, a guy catches a sardine, and after telling it over a few times, it becomes a whale. So maybe that's what happened. So we explained also that that's also improbable. Because if it had changed, it should have changed 10, 15, 20 different ways. There were never another parallel Mesorah. Like there should be 10 different versions of Kriyas Yamsuf. They went scuba diving under the sea. They went built a raft. The sea split. They jumped over it. Whatever. There was never, even though there's arguments in the details, how many paths there were, whatever, but there never was another Mesorah that there wasn't a Kriyas Yamsuf. And even the Christians and the Muslims believe in Kriyas Yamsuf. So, and even the ones who don't believe in the Mesorah, Karoyim, Sedukim, Conservative, Reform, they don't claim to have another Mesorah. They just don't believe in Mesorah. They don't have an alternate Mesorah that's different. So there should have been tens of Mesorahs if it changed. Must be that it didn't change, and the reason it didn't change is because people gave it over very, very carefully because they believe that their life and their future life depends on it. So of all the possibilities of how the Mesorah got to us, that an entire nation witnessed all these things, the only one that's probable is it really happened. So therefore, speaking about it intellectually, right, intellectually identifies you with Yetzias Mitzrayim, not to feel like you were actually there, but to feel that what that represented is real. It really happened. Because the more you go into it, the more you feel that you can identify with it because it's if you were there. That's the idea. So it's an intellectual connection, not an actual physical connection, first thing. The second way is through the eating. We eat matzah, moror, korban pesach. The question is asked by the Shurei Das. Those are very subtle things. You want to, you know, what's it called? You want to remember the 210 years of Egyptian oppression and bitterness. So he says, why don't you see a play? You know, the Goyim do that on Easter. They have a passion play. They see this one's Mary and this one's Yashka, and they see everything portrayed, and they go home feeling like they were there. Right? I remember when the Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille came out years and years ago. I was about 10 years old. And my Hebrew school that I was attending took us to see it. Okay? Before it hit the theaters. And I remember as a 10-year-old thinking, about 8 years old, thinking that if Cecil B. DeMille could split the Red Sea, then God could do it too. And it really strengthened my emunah. So that's what you have. Steven Spielberg make they have the Prince of Egypt or whatever, but not, that's a cartoon, something real with special effects, right? Right, special effects. And no, that movie made a tremendous impression. Because whenever I think of Moshe or Paro, I think of Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. I can't.
There's a new movie coming out.
I can't.
A new movie coming out called Noah. It's got all the special effects they say.
I hear. Okay. So that would make much more of an impression than what we do, right? I would make a Seder, invite 20 people, split them into two groups, have 10 of them build pyramids while they get beaten by the other group, and then switch places. I guarantee the people came to my Seder would really feel that they were slaves in Egypt to win free. Now, they may not come back the next year, but more than what God's idea is, okay, you want to feel now 210 years of oppression and bitterness, eat some lettuce, right? That doesn't exactly capture the... So what was God thinking? Right? Why did he give us a mitzvah so subtle? So the Shurei Das says the following. I'm going to give you first an example to what he says. There's such a concept called subliminal advertising. You don't come along and say, drink Coke. But in a film about who knows what, you splice in a frame or two that says drink Coke, or that shows you a luscious, icy Coca-Cola bottle. You don't even see it consciously. It goes directly into your subconscious. They found that it's like a hypnotic suggestion, and people have this irresistible urge to drink Coke. Says the Shurei Das, something that hits your external makes an impression, but it wears off. Something that bypasses the external, goes directly into your neshama, makes more of an impression. Therefore, the Torah's mitzvahs are very subtle, because they have to affect your neshama, not your body. The first part of the Seder is intellectual. That affects your your external. But the eating part goes into your kishkas, literally, right? But not your physical kishkas, into your neshama. And I always like to compare it, when we pass through the 15th day of Nisan, it's like a time zone. That time is permeated with the remembrance of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's like every day of the year is another zone of time. And we constantly go around and come back to that time zone. It's like an elevator shaft. We're now on the 5,774th floor. But down on the 2,448th floor was Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the memory is in that shaft. When you pass through it, you're passing through that memory, but you have to connect in. You want to connect your neshama, so it's like connecting two computers. Where you have one memory in one, and you want the memory to flow into the other. So you need a cable, and you need the right kind of command, and then the memory will flow from one computer to the other. You can't tie the cable around the monitor. It's not going to work. It's not going to go from one monitor to the other. You have to get into the guts of the computer, and it'll flow from one to the other. So you need the right kind of cable with the right kind of pins. The cable doesn't have to look anything like the memory that you're transferring, but it has to be the right amount of pins and the right configuration, the right size. Same thing. The Rebbe Shem wants that memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim to go into our neshama. We're passing through that night. You need something to connect you. That's why the connection has to be very subtle. Matzah, mar, whatever. But that's what connects it directly into your neshama. And therefore, it's like a battery charger. When you charge a battery, you don't see it glow. If you do, run. Right? It's charged. It looks the same as it did before. But now it's charged up. The same thing. You may not feel anything. But if you've done the mitzvahs properly, you ate them the right amount, at the right time, in the right way, right, then you made the connection. If you didn't eat them the right way, the right amount or whatever, then it's like having a cable with the wrong amount of pins, or they're not the same size, or the wrong configuration, it's not going to make the connection. So, you have to have it, but if you do that, then the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which you're going through that night, charges up your soul. And it has an effect on you for the rest of the year, even though you may not feel it externally. That's another way that you identify with the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, by connecting in to that time zone. And lastly, it says there's a third way of identifying with it. It says that we were in Mitzrayim 430 years. And at the end of 430 years, we left the land of Egypt. When they translated the Torah into Greek for Talmid HaMelech, they changed that pasuk. And they put, we were in Egypt 430 years and in other lands. Because we weren't in Egypt 430 years. We're only in Egypt 210 years. And you can figure it out because we know that Levi went into Mitzrayim. And if you add Levi's life and his son Kahas and his son Amram and 80 years of Moshe, and you put them, what's it called, one after the other, right, consecutively, they don't add to 430 years. And they didn't live consecutively, they lived concurrently. So there wasn't 430 years time between the ones who came into Mitzrayim and the ones who went out. The whole idea of the 430 years started from when Yitzchak Avinu was born, or even before that. So we weren't in Egypt. What do we do with the pasuk? It doesn't say other lands. So I was thinking, it says in the beginning of the pasuk, the sojourn of the Jewish people in Egypt, in Mitzrayim. And the end of the pasuk says, at the end of 430 years, we left Eretz Mitzrayim, the land of Egypt. There's a significant difference between Mitzrayim and Eretz Mitzrayim. Eretz Mitzrayim is a geographic place. Mitzrayim is a state of being. We were 430 years in Mitzrayim, in a state of being tzekvetched, what's it called? Constrained, constricted. Meitzar, minha meitzar karosiko. We couldn't express our essence. From the time Yitzchak was born, with Ger Yeber, we were a stranger even in Eretz Yisrael. We weren't able to express our essence. So we were in a meitzar. And when we left the land of Egypt, which is the place in the world where that meitzar, that constriction and constraint is the greatest. That's the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara constrains you and constricts you. Doesn't let you do what you really want to do, what your neshama wants to do. So we were in Mitzrayim 430 years. We weren't in Eretz Mitzrayim, except the last 210. When it says that you have to identify with Yetzias Mitzrayim, it doesn't say, right, Bavur zo asar shem li betseisi me Eretz Mitzrayim. Betseisi me Mitzrayim. And that's what it says. Bechol dor vador chayiv adam liros es atzmo ke'ilu hu yatsam mi Mitzrayim, not Eretz Mitzrayim. Every generation has its Mitzrayim, its constraints and constriction. Every person has their Mitzrayim, where there's a slave to various things. And every Pesach night, we have the ability to free ourselves of our own personal Mitzrayim, of the generation's Mitzrayim. There's an ongoing Mitzrayim and Yetzias Mitzrayim every year. So a person has to identify with his own Mitzrayim, his own constraints and constrictions, what he is a slave to, and be able to feel that Pesach night, he can at least start the process to become free. So therefore, it's an emotional thing to identify with Mitzrayim, not Pharaoh of old, but the ongoing Mitzrayim. So those are three ways that a person fulfills this. The first way is intellectually speaking about it, and identifying intellectually with the fact that it really happened, that it's true, because of the facts that we mentioned. The second way is neshama-wise, by charging up your neshama, by connecting into the memory of that time zone through the eatings that you do Pesach night. And the third way is emotionally, by identifying with your own Mitzrayim, your own slavery, right, and feeling that you have the ability to free yourself of that. So therefore, you don't have to actually feel like you were in Mitzrayim and no paro and you don't never saw these things. But if you fulfill the mitzvahs properly, you speak about Yetzias Mitzrayim, you identify it with intellectually, you fulfill the mitzvahs properly, your neshama is, and you emotionally identify personally with this idea of slavery and freedom, then you fulfill the mitzvah. So at the end of the Seder, you can feel less frustrated if you didn't feel like you were in Egypt with Paro, but if you fulfill the mitzvahs properly, then your neshama has been charged up, intellectually you're strengthened, and emotionally you have that's what the mitzvah is. Okay, I wish you all a chag kosher v'sameach.